He was a white stone, but the stone looked somehow soft like flesh, and the hard, soft marble curved and rippled into muscles and veins, tiny and large, subtle and blunt, each feature easing inevitably into the next, all the way around. My eye kept roaming, looking for imperfections, not finding any. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, Episode 12, David's Death and the Rise of Solomon. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. A fascinating article in the New York Times by Sam Anderson is titled, David's Ankles, How Imperfections Could Bring Down the World's Most Perfect Statue. The subject, of course, is Michelangelo's David in Florence. The great Renaissance artist gives us David as a Greek god, an ageless, immortal young man, eternally poised to launch his stone at Goliath. The statue appears to be the embodiment of perfection. But is it? In the piece, Anderson describes the genuine imperfection that has made itself manifest in this sculpture. Quote, "The trouble is the David's ankles. They are cracked. Italians first discovered this weakness back in the 19th century, and modern scientists have mapped the cracks extensively. But until recently, no one claimed to know just how enfeebled the ankles might be. This changed in 2014, when a team of Italian geoscientists published a paper called Modeling the Failure Mechanisms of Michelangelo's David Through Small-Scale Centrifuge Experiments. That dry title concealed a terrifying story. The paper describes an experiment designed to measure in a novel way the weakness in the David's ankles by creating a small army of tiny David replicas and spinning them in a centrifuge at various angles to simulate different levels of real-world stress. What the researchers found was grim. If the David were to be tilted 15 degrees, his ankles would fail. Anderson adds that for several hundred years, the David leaned at an angle of several degrees. That doesn't sound like much, but when you're dealing with 6 tons bearing down every second of every minute of every day of every year of every century, it is plenty. Hairline fractures work their way slowly through the stone. The right leg is significantly worse than the left. As the tilt of the statue increases, the stress will move higher and higher up that leg until, at the moment of failure, it will break off just below the knee." End quote. This imperfection, in other words, endangers the statue's permanent purported perfection. Or to put it slightly differently, if in Greek poetry and myth, the godlike Achilles has a mortal heel, the seemingly divine David has Achilles' ankles. And the imperfection in this image of David highlights the irony inherent in the sculpture itself. For when the prophet Samuel was first sent to Bethlehem to anoint a new king after Saul, he sought someone who looked like a mighty warrior, and God sternly responded that the prophet's criteria was misguided. "Look not to his appearance or to his height," God says, "for I have rejected these," adding, "for man looks with the eyes, but God looks to the heart." To celebrate David as a Greek god is, in other words, to miss the point, for in the end, the shepherd selected as the monarch of Israel was indeed imperfect, but it was in the midst of his imperfections that his heart revealed its true greatness. And it is this king who, in the last stage of his life, must look back on his great but imperfect legacy, will make a choice that will forever determine the future of Jerusalem. The book of Samuel, which is largely about David, concludes with the story that we described in our previous episode, David dedicating an altar on what will become the Temple Mount. But the opportunity to build the actual temple has been denied to him. And as the next biblical book, the book of Kings, begins, we find David elderly and unwell, with the most important choice facing him still unmade: who his heir will be. Thus, one of the last scenes of David's life, given to us by the Bible, is of a dying king choosing his successor. David's eldest living son, Adoniah, has already proclaimed himself king, or as we are told in verse 5. "Then Adoniah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, 'I will be king.' And he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, 'Why hast thou done so?' And he was also a goodly man, and his mother bore him after Absalom." We are further informed that many of the captains of the host, meaning the generals, acclaimed Adoniah as king, and we can intuitively understand this. After all, if Adoniah was, as the Bible tells us, a goodly man, this means that he reminded the generals of the young, mighty warrior that David once was. Adoniah, in other words, was much like that David depicted in Michelangelo's Florence, virile and strong. And we are also told that David delivered no reprimand to Adoniah, despite the fact that David had previously promised his wife Bathsheba that her son Solomon would reign. How are we to understand David's hesitancy? There is the fact that, as the text emphasizes, Adoniah is the full brother of Absalom, next in line after the son who had rebelled against David, the son whose death David regretted. But we must also mark that at this point, as the Bible makes clear, Solomon is but a boy, and David, knowing he is dying, is obviously afraid to place Jerusalem and its future into the hands of a child. It is Adoniah who superficially seems more like David, but as Samuel's story taught us, it is not the superficial that matters most. Sam Anderson further reflects in the Times how when he first saw Michelangelo's David as a young man, he was awed by its beauty. Quote, "When I first saw the David in person, the only word that came to mind was perfect. Why hadn't anyone ever told me he was perfect? I was 20 years old, exhausted, unwashed, traveling for the first time ever, ignorant of almost everything worth knowing. Perfect, I know now, is not a terribly original response to the statue, nor a very precise one, but in that moment it filled my mind. It felt like a revolution, urgent, deep, vital, and true." And Anderson adds, "He was a giant marble god, except he wasn't a god. He was a man, but then, of course, he wasn't really a man either. He was a white stone, but the stone looked somehow soft like flesh, and the hard, soft marble curved and rippled into muscles and veins, tiny and large, subtle and blunt, each feature easing inevitably into the next. All the way around, my eye kept roaming, looking for imperfections, not finding any." End quote. But of course, ladies and gentlemen, this is not the embodiment of perfection from a Hebraic perspective. For, to paraphrase by Jonathan Sacks, whereas the ancient Greeks revered the holiness of beauty, Jews celebrate the beauty of holiness. Jerusalem is indeed to become a beautiful city, but it will be its holiness that will matter most, and its rulers are called to reflect this holiness. Thus, David's choice at the end of his reign goes back to Samuel's choice at its very beginning. One of David's sons has the appearance of his prowess. The other child, who is but a boy, has his heart, his character. The question facing David therefore pertains to the very nature of succession. Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein, whose writings on the story have impacted my reflections, puts it this way, quote, "The choice between the two alternatives involves selecting what is fundamental as opposed to incidental in the deceased's legacy, that is to say, the moral and religious values that will be continued by the son who is quiet and different in nature, as opposed to the activity and vigor that characterized the other son. The decision is clearly made in favor of morality and holiness. And thus we learn that the successor to family tradition or political leadership need not adopt the same style of leadership as his predecessor, but he must follow in the footsteps of the previous leader's values. It is the new leader's right and obligation to lead in accordance with the inclination of his heart and the needs of his generation, while preserving those basic values, but he need not adhere precisely to his predecessor's policies." End quote. Indeed, and in the end, David makes the right choice. Or as the Bible tells us, "And King David said, call me Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada. And they came before the king. The king said unto them, take with you the servants of your Lord and cause Solomon my son to ride upon my own donkey and bring him down to Gihon. And let Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him there king over Israel and blow with the shofar and say, long live King Solomon." The choice of the next ruler of Jerusalem between the mighty Adoniah and the wise child Solomon thus reflects a larger question. What is Jerusalem about? Is it first and foremost an embodiment of power? If so, Adoniah is the appropriate choice. And if he is not, if what matters is not height but heart, then that is because Jerusalem is defined first and foremost by its summit, the site of its altar and its future temple, which reminds us of Israel's special relationship with God. David makes this clear as he hands over to Solomon before he dies the plans for the temple in a scene described in Chronicles. "Then David the king stood up upon his feet and said, hear me, my brethren and my people. As for me, I had in my heart to build a house of dwelling for the ark of the covenant of the Lord. I had in my heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God, and had made ready for the building. But God said unto me, thou shalt not build a house for my name, because thou hast been a man of war and hast shed blood. However, the Lord God of Israel chose me before all the house of my father to be king over Israel forever. For he hath chosen Judah to be the ruler, and of the house of Judah the house of my father. And among the sons of my father he loved me to make me king over all Israel. And of all my sons, for the Lord hath given me many sons, He hath chosen Solomon, my son, to sit upon the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. David was a warrior. For this, he is a hero. But if the temple had been built by him, it would have been seen by so many as a testament to his might. Whereas David's most enduring legacy is his heart. Imperfect indeed, but all the more real to us, precisely because of its imperfections and because of the way in which his faith and penitence were made manifest. It is David's relationship with the divine that Israel will seek in the temple of which David dreamed, a temple that will define David's legacy even more than it will Solomon's. Thus, in Jerusalem, the curtain falls on David's life. And as the once mighty and now frail king chooses his successor, his own failures are very much on his mind. But because of his choice, the endurance of his vision of what Jerusalem will be persists. And in the end, it is Jerusalem, to this day, much more than a statue in Florence, that serves as the truest memorial for who David was. Sam Anderson, after describing the dangers of what might occur to Michelangelo's slightly cracked statue, if it tilts even further, reflects that while he once saw the sculpture as a beacon of perfection, now he is wiser. Quote, "Perfection, it turns out, is no way to try to live. It is a child's idea, a cartoon. This desire not to be merely good, not to do merely well, but to be faultless, to transcend everything, including the limits of yourself." End quote. Perfection is indeed no way to try to live. And it is in the final act of David's imperfect but legendary leadership that the stage is set for Jerusalem to achieve one of its greatest moments. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.